Again, the court calls United States v. Gutierrez, please.
May it please the court. My name is Captain Brian Andes, and I, along with Major Vincent Schuler, represent PFC Gutierrez, the appellant in this matter. Here, the prosecution relied on evidence of rape, an alleged rape, in order to prove stalking. Stalking requires a fear, a course of conduct, and that PFC Gutierrez knew or should have known that his behavior would place Ms. A.M. in fear. The evidence is legally insufficient to show that Ms. A.M. was in fear and that PFC Gutierrez knew or should have known that Ms. A.M. was in fear on two or more occasions, where the government relied on evidence of an alleged rape and PFC Gutierrez was subsequently acquitted of that rape, alleged rape. That was the only evidence that the government put on at trial in order to establish the fear element of the course of conduct that Ms. A.M. had to be in fear, in reasonable fear, and that PFC Gutierrez had to know or should have known of Ms. A.M.'s fear.
Well, now, he was acquitted of the rape, so I don't think the government can come up and argue that he raped her. But certainly for the stalking offense, cannot they use that underlying factual situation as it was presented to the members to establish that that was an offense under the stalking statute, or that was part of a course of conduct?
Yes, Your Honor. However, that underlying factual scenario is of itself legally insufficient also. To prove the fear that Ms. A.M. was placed in at trial, the government presented three instances of which PFC Gutierrez went to Ms. A.M.'s home, one time in early August, one time late August, early September, and then October 2nd. The alleged, the reported rape took place allegedly in the early August instance. Looking at just the record of trial, there's no evidence, and the government didn't ask or put anything on at trial that would show that Ms. A.M. was placed in fear. They didn't ask her if she was afraid.
Well, the third element of stalking. There was testimony that the daughter was freaking out. Was there not?
Yes,
there testimony from a staff sergeant, Rojas, that she sounded stressed, like she was in fear?
Yes, Your Honor.
And may reasonable members infer that a single woman with a 9-year-old daughter who has a man standing on her front door ringing her doorbell for 1 hour might be placed in fear? Is that not an inference a reasonable member might be able to draw?
There's no evidence that PFC Gutierrez conveyed any threats on that. I believe with regard to ringing the doorbell, Your Honor, you're referring to the incident that took place at the end of August or early September. PFC Gutierrez. The middle incident. PFC Gutierrez showed up at Ms. A.M.'s home. Ms. A.M. testified on the record that she told him to leave. He didn't leave. She told him to leave, or he should call his wife, and then she told him to leave.
Or call the police.
And then she would call the police, and then he finally
left. Now, do people call the police just when, I mean, I guess they call the police for all sorts of reasons, but can a reasonable member infer from that she might have felt fear?
No, Your Honor, because there's no evidence that she did actually feel fear or that PFC Gutierrez was doing any threatening behavior. Looking at the text and the Facebook messages surrounding that instance, which the government concedes in its brief are by themselves non-threatening, we don't know what PFC Gutierrez's motive was going to her house. On the middle instance. And with regard to, you were referring to earlier,
regional fear of bodily harm, is that derived from the accused subjective purpose, or is that subjective to the victim, or is it an objective and reasonable standard? It's a neutral question.
It's got to be, looking at the elements of stalking, it's got to be a reasonable fear. So it would be an objective standard, objective reasonableness, of fear of bodily harm. And in that second, the middle instance also, based on Ms. A.M.'s description of what took place on the third instance, we know that there's two doors at least that PFC Gutierrez had to get through. He was standing outside ringing a doorbell on an outside door to her apartment. There was still the door to her actual apartment. She was communicating with him via the intercom. And with regard to Miss A.M. hiding underneath the mattress or the comforter with her daughter, that took place on the final instance. And a reasonable fact finder can't look back and say that because Miss A.M. was placed in fear on the final instance, therefore she should have been placed in fear on the earlier instances. That, the third and final instance at which PFC Gutierrez shows up at Miss A.M.'s home, is the only time that PFC Gutierrez engaged in anything that could possibly be interpreted as threatening.
But if the members believed that something happened on the initial assault, or whatever you want to call it, that was charged as a rape, and then later he showed up and sat on our front porch and rang the doorbell, isn't it reasonable to assume that a person who has been sexually assaulted, if that is what the members believe, something happened there, and the person later showed up and rang the bell, that would also instill fear?
It would be reasonable, yes, Your Honor, but we don't know what took place on that first instance because...
Well, we don't, but we're looking at it most favorably to the government.
And based on just the standard spillover instruction that was given to the panel, we don't know how the panel viewed that first instance, if they viewed that anything happened at all. It's possible that the panel decided that PFC Gutierrez didn't go to her house at all. The military judge didn't address a scenario wherein...
Well, do we have to worry about what they specifically, what the panel thought about it? Aren't we only looking at what, if there is sufficient evidence, if we give it all the preferences that we can, that a reasonable panel would have come back?
The first instance, yes, Your Honor. However, the first instance, the allegation of a rape aside, the first instance, based on what came out on the record of trial, is insufficient of itself to show that Miss A.M. was placed in fear or that PFC Gutierrez reasonably should have known that Miss A.M. was placed in fear. From the record, Miss A.M. testified that she said no to PFC Gutierrez. There is no follow-up question as to why she said no. If the unreasonable to infer that necessarily she said no because she was afraid, that wasn't alleged. It wasn't a rape by, it was a rape by force, so the fear element wasn't required. And there was no evidence that he placed Miss A.M. in fear on that first instance, or if the first instance, if the panel found that the first instance happened. And the standard spillover instruction that the military judge gave addressed a scenario where the judge instructed the panel on how they could use evidence of conviction of rape in order to find reasonableness of Miss A.M.'s fear, but did not address the scenario where they acquitted PFC Gutierrez of rape and then how to establish a course of conduct with regard to whether Miss A.M. was actually placed in fear, whether PFC Gutierrez knew that Miss A.M. was placed in fear, if they acquitted of the first instance.
What do you think that
instruction should have looked like? The military should have given some instruction along the lines of, if the panel has doubt that PFC Gutierrez had sexual intercourse or used force in order to engage in that sexual intercourse with Miss A.M., but still believed that PFC Gutierrez knew or should have known that Miss A.M. was placed in fear of bodily harm on the night in question, and that she was actually placed in fear, then they may consider that in order to establish a course of conduct with regard to stalking and reaching a guilty verdict for stalking. However, if the panel found that sexual intercourse occurred but was consensual, or that PFC Gutierrez had a mistake of fact as to whether Ms. A.M. consented, then it couldn't be used in order to inform a subsequent decision as to whether Ms. A.M. was placed in fear. Because obviously in that situation, PFC Gutierrez could not have known that Ms. A.M. was afraid if he also believed that Ms. A.M. was consenting.
Well, what is the defense's theory of what happened that night? Or what is your argument about what happened? Or are you just saying whatever happened, it wasn't Ray?
Yeah, exactly, Your Honor. We don't know.
Okay, he went over there and delivered the packages, and whatever happened after that, he didn't rape her.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
We don't know what happened.
We don't know what happened. Okay.
And with regard, looking at only the second instance, assuming we don't know what happened in the first instance, moving to the second instance at the end of August, early September, that visit to Ms. A.M.'s home, as I was saying earlier, there's at least two doors standing between Ms. A.M. and P.F.C. Gutierrez. Ms. A.M. was communicating to P.F.C. Gutierrez through an intercom, and there's no indication that she was in fear. And the government is correct in their brief when they say, in order for a panel to convict on the stalking, the reasonable fact finder needed to find that a rape happened on that first instance, or that something happened that would place Ms. A.M.
So you're saying that we're talking about inconsistent verdicts?
It's not an inconsistent verdict, Your Honor.
You don't want it to be an inconsistent verdict because then Apollo and Dunn destroy your argument, right?
Not necessarily. Apollo and Dunn would destroy my argument if Apollo and Dunn came down with, Dunn, for example, to quickly state what happened in that case. Dunn was found guilty of wrongfully possessing liquor, but acquitted of creating a nuisance by wrongfully storing liquor. If one of those was legally insufficient, then obviously the other would be legally insufficient. This case before us is a legal sufficiency argument. The rape, or the alleged rape, what happened on that first instance is legally insufficient. Therefore, everything that happened, that the government based arguments regarding that legally insufficient
instance. So you're saying that the evidence of the rape is legally insufficient?
Well,
I mean, he was acquitted of the rape, but let's assume that he wasn't acquitted of the rape. Are you saying that the evidence would be legally insufficient?
No, Your Honor. The way the government argued it at trial was that PFC Gutierrez needed to be found guilty of rape in order to be found guilty of stalking. So that would establish that he knew or should have known that Ms. A.M. was placed in fear, and that Ms. A.M. was placed in fear. But here we have a rape by force. So simply being found guilty of the rape doesn't necessarily
a separate question than what you're just talking about. Just on the record, and I understand that he was not convicted of any sort of rape, but on the record as it stands, if he had been convicted of rape, do you agree that the evidence is legally sufficient to support that conviction? Under the Jackson statement.
If he had been convicted of rape, there would at least be something that the government could say PFC Gutierrez knew or should have known Ms. A.M. was placed in fear on one occasion, but...
Okay, we're talking across purposes. Move on to the rest of the argument.
The government relied on the alleged rape in the first instance in order to establish a context as to why Ms. A.M. was placed in fear, why she was afraid of PFC Gutierrez. However, looking at the regular trial, there is insufficient evidence to show whether the fear was reasonable, or whether PFC Gutierrez knew or should have known that Ms. A.M. was placed in fear. As such, the evidence is legally insufficient to uphold the conviction on stalking.
Okay, thank you, counsel. You have time on rebuttal as well. Counsel of the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Campbell Warren, along with Colonel John Carroll. I represent the government. This court should affirm the Army Corps because an inconsistent verdict is not a basis for relief, and this court's legal sufficiency review of the stalking conviction should be conducted independently of the panel's verdict. Such a review shows that the evidence of stalking is legally sufficient to sustain the conviction. I want to turn briefly to the issue of inconsistent verdict. Appellant basically agreed during his portion of the argument that an inconsistent verdict standing alone is not a basis for relief, and that is absolutely correct. Dunn and Howell have held so for a long time. This court has adopted similar reasoning in U.S. v. Jackson, and as recently as 2012 in U.S. v. Stewart noted that an inconsistent verdict standing alone is not a basis for relief. And that's basically the argument that appellant is trying to make, even though he's saying it's not an inconsistent verdict. He's asking this court to disregard all evidence of the rape and look at stalking in a vacuum instead of looking at the entire record as done in Powell.
Before you get to the rape, did he have notice that he was charged with a course of threatening conduct, including a rape? The spec says nothing about a rape. The spec says a course of conduct, including kicking her door and ringing the doorbell and trying to contact her.
Well, sir, I think that he was on notice because with the severance motion, the defense was clearly aware that these charges were going to be tried together and that one was going to play off the other, and that's covered extensively in the joint appendix with not only the severance motion, the government's response there, too, but the Article 39A section. However, let's assume for the sake of argument that the appellant was not on notice that the rape was going to factor into this, and let's look solely at the language of the stalking specification. Well, we've got evidence that he visited her apartment building twice. We have repeated phone calls, repeated text messages. AM testifies that in the first text, her, she responds to the effect of just leave me alone. And then on Prosecution Exhibit 1, she's responding more forcefully, basically saying leave me the fuck alone, I don't know who you are at first, and then being more forceful with me. But repeated instances of AM saying leave me alone.
Well, that, you know, that certainly shows annoyance, but unfortunately that's not the way the statute's written. 134 was written that. 134 was interpreted that way, but since you're stuck with the language of the statute, you've got to show fear. And annoyance does not necessarily rise to the level of fear. You've got to have some evidence of fear.
Well, there is express evidence of fear, Your Honor. The second time that the appellant visits the apartment building and he actually makes it inside, he's kicking on the door.
Well, I think they conceded that, but you've got to have two.
And as the trial counsel argued in closing, Your Honor, after the appellant had been released from CID or from MP custody, but AM was still at the CID station, repeatedly receiving these phone calls, you can certainly infer from that that she would still be in fear. After all, you have a person who has been handcuffed, surrounded by police, and he's still lunging at the victim, licking his lips in a sexual manner, blowing her kisses, saying, let me in. Sergeant France testified that the victim shut the door right away. The victim testified that even before that point, she was freaking out. Staff Sergeant Rosas testified that he heard the fear in the victim's voice during the phone call. So with that instance standing alone, you absolutely have fear.
Counsel, the statute talks about causing a reasonable person to fear death or bodily harm, including sexual assault. What was the government's theory of trial as to what it was she feared?
I believe that the theory was that she was fearing another rape, which the government's theory was she was raped in early to mid-August sometime, and then the conduct continues, so...
So she feared sexual assault?
That's my understanding of the government's theory, ma'am. Now, the way it was charged was just to fear death or bodily harm, so even if that's what the government...
The statute says that includes sexual assault.
It does, but bodily harm also incorporates the definition from the assault statute, which is any offensive touching. So, and of course, the panel would not be bound by the government's theory of the case just because the government argued it that way. If the panel found that she was in fear of some kind of bodily harm, however slight it might have been, that's enough to sustain a conviction.
Counsel, I think that in your brief you conceded or agreed that the phone messages and the texts did not constitute threats.
They're not overtly threatening, Your Honor.
Wait a minute. Let me finish my question.
Yes.
So, how does that fit in when we are trying to determine a course of conduct when you look at the definition in the statute of course of conduct?
Well, sir, a course of conduct can either be express threats, verbal or physical, or it can be threats implied by conduct, and that's where this court's view of the entire record comes in, not just the parts that the appellant wants this court to look at. So you consider the fact that you've got this rape charge out there. Now, the appellant was acquitted of rape, but, sir, to go back to your point that you made during Captain Andy's argument, the panel could have thought that something creepy happened and it was not a rape, maybe consensual, maybe not, but there's certainly enough evidence to where a reasonable fact finder could infer that something happened that was not consensual. The victim and the appellant's wife both testified that AM and the appellant did not get along. Even though they didn't get along, the appellant was already there for much longer than it would have taken to simply walk over there, drop off packages, and then go back home. So all that leads to the conclusion that, or could lead a reasonable fact finder to infer something illegal, something creepy, something untoward happened in there. So even if they find it's not a rape, then...
The government has to show beyond a reasonable. If you're hanging your hat on this rape or this incident, you got to show beyond a reasonable doubt that she was put in fear. And what's the government's theory? It's not enough to say that something creepy happened.
But again, we have express evidence of fear in the record, Your Honor, with her testimony with the second visit, the one on
the second visit, I think, is conceded, is it not?
It is. And then
I'm not talking about the second visit.
Well, what I'm saying, sir, is standing alone, if we take appellant's argument at face value, if we assume that that is the law and we sweep away all evidence of the rape, we still have this apartment visit on October 2nd. And then after that, after he has been taken away by the police, we have a break in time. He has been released from CID custody. The victim is at CID undergoing an interview, and he's still ringing her phone, still texting him constantly. So he has absolutely been put on notice at that first instance. She is in fear of death or bodily
harm. Okay, so now you're not hanging your hat on the rape. You're hanging your hat on his boorish behavior at CID.
It's an alternative, yes, sir.
It's an alternative. Okay.
So even if this court were to take the appellant's argument at face value, again, the appellant's argument essentially contradicts Dunn and Powell. Despite the assurances to the contrary, they're basically asking this court to disregard them consistently. But assuming that that were the state of the law, and Dunn and Powell did not exist, the law was as the appellant wants it to be, you've got those two instances, you've got the apartment visit on 2 October, you've got the follow-up telephone call. That's enough to satisfy stalking. It's a repeated course of conduct. A reasonable person would absolutely be put in fear of death or bodily harm, given the appellant's behavior.
Is Dunn really apposite? Dunn really is an inconsistent verdict. Seems like this is something else. This is two different statutes with two different kinds of elements. Dunn is basically an LIO. If you look at Dunn, it's really an LIO. So is Dunn even really apposite to this?
Let me answer it this way, Your Honor. The government's not conceding that these are inconsistent verdicts, but based on the manner in which the appellant has presented the issue, it's basically a tactical decision to argue this as, let's assume that the verdicts are inconsistent and proceed on that.
Well, but that's not what I'm asking. I don't care whether you think this is inconsistent. I'm saying, is Dunn apposite to this?
I think Dunn absolutely applies to this, Your Honor.
Why?
Because what Dunn establishes is that if you have inconsistent verdicts, understanding that these verdicts are not inconsistent, there's at least a good argument that they're not. But if verdicts are inconsistent, legal sufficiency review is conducted independently of the panel's verdict. So it wouldn't make sense for legal sufficiency review to be conducted independently of the panel's verdict if they were not inconsistent. Basically, no matter whether they're inconsistent or not, this court's review is independent of the panel's verdict.
Well, yeah, but Dunn doesn't say that. Go ahead. You're not answering my question, but go ahead.
That's basically the logical implication of Dunn, though, Your Honor, is if you have verdicts that are inconsistent, the legal sufficiency review is conducted independently. Ergo, if you have verdicts that are not inconsistent, legal sufficiency review should still be conducted independently. It's a de novo review. So Dunn and the standard of review for legal sufficiency basically imply that.
Thank you.
Counsel, if the phone calls and text messages were not considered part of the course of conduct here, do you still win?
I believe so, Your Honor. Again, taking the evidence in light most favorable to the government, we have the visit of 2 October, which, again, the appellant has conceded there would be fear of death or bodily harm there. We've got the first visit to the apartment where he's constantly ringing the doorbell for an hour. That's not normal behavior. And before that point, he had been told, leave me alone. Even if the calls and text messages themselves were not threatening, the victim had told the appellant multiple times, leave me alone, I don't want to talk to you. And at one point she had said, leave before I call the police. I believe that's with this second intermediate visit to the apartment. So even if the calls and the text messages themselves are not considered to be threats implied by conduct, there's still ample evidence drawing all inferences in favor of the government that the stalking conviction can be affirmed. Any further questions?
There are no further questions. Thank you, counsel. We'll now have opportunity for rebuttal, please. Do you need more time? You're allowed to talk for a second if you'd like.
Just briefly, I would like to just reiterate that fear, as you said, Judge Stuckey, fear.
That was close. You're almost in big trouble, but go ahead.
Sorry.
Don't go there.
Fear does not equal annoying behavior. Annoying behavior does not equal fear. And text messages and phone calls, although annoying and a visit to the house, although annoying, do not fear me. Take out the phone calls and the text messages and the...
Just to be clear on which element, I understand your argument, but does not fear make because she didn't feel fear, because a reasonable person wouldn't feel fear, or because the accused would not have known that a person would feel fear?
Yes, yeah, all of the above.
All of the above, so you're not so fear, okay.
There's no way PFC Gutierrez could have known that she was placed in fear. There's no evidence that Ms. A.M. was actually placed in fear, and then a reasonable person could not have found it such. And pending further questions, that's
all right. Well, thank you both counsel, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.
All right. Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.